This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents The Return of Marco Polo's World, War, Strategy, and American Interests in the 21st Century by Robert D. Kaplan. Read for you by Eric Martin. To Elizabeth M. Lockyer. The origins of hot wars lie in cold wars, and the origins of cold wars are found in the anarchic ordering of the international arena. Theorists explain what historians know. War is normal. Kenneth N. Waltz, 1988. Strategy. 1. The Return of Marco Polo's World and the U.S. Military Response. As Europe disappears, Eurasia coheres. The supercontinent is becoming one fluid, comprehensible unit of trade and conflict, as the Westphalian system of states weakens, and older imperial legacies, Russian, Chinese, Iranian, Turkish, become paramount. Every crisis from Central Europe to the ethnic Han Chinese heartland is now interlinked. There is one singular battle space. What follows is a historical and geographical guide to it. The dispersion of the West. Never before in history did Western civilization reach such a point of geopolitical concision and raw power as during the Cold War and its immediate aftermath. For well over half a century, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, condensed a millennia-long tradition of political and moral values, the West, in shorthand, into a robust military alliance. NATO was a cultural phenomenon before it was anything. Its spiritual roots reach back to the philosophical and administrative legacies of Greece and Rome, to the emergence of Christendom in the early Middle Ages, and to the Enlightenment in the 17th and 18th centuries, from which the ideas of the American Revolution emerged. Of course, key nations of the West fought as an alliance in the First and Second World Wars, and those emergency contingencies constituted forerunners to NATO's more secure and elaborate structures. Such structures, in turn, were buttressed by a continent-wide economic system, culminating in the European Union, EU. The EU gave both political support and quotidian substance to the values inherent in NATO, those values being generally the rule of law over arbitrary fiat, legal states over ethnic nations, and the protection of the individual no matter his race or religion. Democracy, after all, is less about elections than about impartial institutions. The end of the long European War, 1914 to 1989, saw those values reign triumphant as communism was finally defeated and NATO and the EU extended their systems throughout Central and Eastern Europe, from the Baltic Sea in the north to the Black Sea in the south. And it categorically was a long European war, as wartime deprivations, political and economic, existed in Soviet satellite states until 1989, when the West triumphed over Europe's second totalitarian system, just as it did over the first in 1945. Civilizations often prosper in opposition to others. Just as Christendom achieved form and substance in opposition to Islam after the latter's conquest of North Africa and the Levant in the 7th and 8th centuries, the West forged a definitive geopolitical paradigm in opposition to Nazi Germany and Soviet Russia. And because the aftershocks of the long European war extended to the very end of the 20th century, with the dissolution of Yugoslavia and chaos inside Russia, NATO and the EU remained as relevant as ever, with NATO demonstrating its expeditionary capability in the case of Yugoslavia, and the EU building inroads into the former Warsaw Pact to take advantage of Russia's infirmity. This era was called the post-Cold War. That is, it was defined in terms of what came before it and what still continued to influence it. The long European War, which lasted three quarters of a century, influences events still, and constitutes my entry point for describing a new world far beyond Europe that the U.S. military now must grapple with. And because Europe's current predicament constitutes an introduction to that new world, I begin with it. It was the monumental devastation of two world wars that led European elites, beginning in the late 1940s, to reject the past altogether, with all of its inherent cultural and ethnic divisions. Only the abstract ideals of the Enlightenment were preserved, which in turn led to political engineering and economic experimentation, so that the specific moral response to the human suffering of 1914 to 1918 and 1939 to 1945 was the establishment of generous social welfare states, which meant highly regulated economies. As for the national political conflicts that gave birth to the two world wars, they would not be repeated because, in addition to other aspects of supranational cooperation, European elites imposed a single monetary unit on much of the continent. Except in the most disciplined northern European societies, however, those social welfare states have proven unaffordable, just as the single currency has caused the weaker economies of southern Europe to pile up massive debt. Alas, the post-World War II attempt at moral redemption has led over time to an intractable form of economic and political hell. The irony deepens. Europe's dull and happy decades in the second half of the 20th century were partially born of its demographic separation from the Muslim Middle East. This, too, was a product of the Cold War phase of the long European war, when totalitarian prison states in such places as Libya, Syria, and Iraq were propped up for decades by Soviet advice and support, and afterward took on a life of their own. For a long time, Europe was lucky in this regard. It could reject power politics and preach human rights precisely because tens of millions of Muslims nearby were being denied human rights, and with them, the freedom of movement. But those Muslim prison states have all but collapsed, either on their own or by outside interference, unleashing a tide of refugees into debt-ridden and economically stagnant European societies. Europe now fractures from within as reactionary populism takes hold, and new borders go up throughout the continent to prevent the movement of Muslim refugees from one country to another. Meanwhile, Europe dissolves from without, as it is reunited with the destiny of Afro-Eurasia as a whole. All this follows naturally from geography and history. For centuries in early and middle antiquity, Europe meant the entire Mediterranean basin, or Mare Nostrum, our sea, as the Romans famously called it, which included North Africa until the Arab invasion of late antiquity. This underlying reality never actually went away. In the mid-20th century, the French geographer Fernand Braudel intimated that Europe's real southern border was not Italy or Greece, but the Sahara Desert, where caravans of migrants now assemble for the journey north. Europe, at least in the way that we have known it, has begun to vanish. And with it, the West itself, at least as a sharply defined geopolitical force, also loses substantial definition. Of course, the West as a civilizational concept has been in crisis for quite some time. The very obvious fact that courses in Western civilization are increasingly rare and controversial on most college campuses in the United States indicates the effect of multiculturalism in a world of intensified cosmopolitan interactions. Noting how Rome only partially inherited the ideals of Greece, and how the Middle Ages virtually lost the ideals of Rome, the 19th century liberal Russian intellectual Alexander Herzen observed that modern Western thought will pass into history and be incorporated in it, will have its influence and its place, just as our body will pass into the composition of grass, of sheep, of cutlets, and of men. We do not like that kind of immortality, but what is to be done about it? Indeed, Western civilization is not being destroyed. Rather, it is being diluted and dispersed. After all, how exactly does one define globalization? Beyond the breakdown of economic borders, it is the worldwide adoption of the American form of capitalism and management practices that, merging with the advance of human rights, another Western concept, has allowed for the most eclectic forms of cultural combinations, wearing down in turn the historical division between East and West. Having won the long European war, the West, rather than go on to conquer the rest of the world, is now beginning to lose itself in what Reinhold Niebuhr called a vast web of history. The decomposition that Herzen spoke of has begun. A new strategic geography. As Europe disappears, Eurasia coheres. I do not mean to say that Eurasia is becoming unified or even stable in the manner that Europe was during the Cold War and the post-Cold War, only that the interactions of globalization, technology, and geopolitics, with each reinforcing the other, are leading the Eurasian supercontinent to become, analytically speaking, one fluid and comprehensible unit. Eurasia simply has meaning in the way that it didn't used to. Moreover, because of the reunification of the Mediterranean basin, evinced by refugees from North Africa and the Levant flooding Europe, and because of dramatically increased interactions across the Indian Ocean from Indochina to East Africa, we may now speak of Afro-Eurasia in one breath. The term world island, early 20th century British geographer Halford Mackinder's phrase for Eurasia joined with Africa, is no longer premature. The slowly vanishing West abets this development by depositing its seeds of unity into an emerging global culture that spans continents. Further encouraging this process is the erosion of distance by way of technology. New roads, bridges, ports, airplanes, massive container ships, and fiber optic cables. It is important, though, to realize that all this constitutes only one layer of what is happening, for there are more troubling changes, too. Precisely because religion and culture are being weakened by globalization, they have to be reinvented in more severe, monochromatic, and ideological form by way of the communications revolution. Witness Boko Haram and the Islamic State, which do not represent Islam per se, but Islam igniting with the tyrannical conformity and mass hysteria inspired by the internet and social media. As I have written previously, it isn't the so-called clash of civilizations that is taking place, but the clash of artificially reconstructed civilizations. And this only hardens geopolitical divides, which, as the collapse of Middle East prison states indicates, are in evidence not only between states, but within states themselves. The combination of violent upheavals and the communications revolution in all its aspects, from cyber interactions to new transportation infrastructure, has wrought a more claustrophobic and ferociously contested world. A world in which territory still matters, and where every crisis interacts with every other as never before. This is all intensified by the expansion of megacities and absolute rises in population. No matter how overcrowded, no matter how much the underground water table and nutrients in the soil have been depleted, people will fight for every patch of ground. On this violent and interactive earth, the neat divisions of Cold War area studies and of continents and subcontinents are starting to be erased as the long European war passes from living memory. Europe, North Africa, the Near East, Central Asia, South Asia, Southeast Asia, East Asia, and the Indian subcontinent are destined to have less and less meaning as geopolitical concepts. Instead, because of the erosion of both hard boundaries and cultural differences, the map will manifest a continuity of subtle gradations which begin in Central Europe and the Adriatic, and end beyond the Gobi Desert, where the agricultural cradle of Chinese civilization begins. Geography counts, but legal borders will matter less so. This world will be increasingly bound by formal obligations that exist both above and below the level of government, a situation that recalls the functionality of feudalism. Just as the medieval Al-Andalus region in Spain and Portugal saw a rich confection of Muslim, Jewish, and Christian civilizations, where the Arabs ruled but forced conversions to Islam did not occur, this emerging world, outside of conflict zones of course, will be one of tolerance and pungent cultural mixes, into which the liberal spirit of the West will dissolve, and only in that way have its place. As for the regional conflicts, they almost always will have global implications, owing to how every part of the earth is now increasingly interwoven with every other part. To wit, local conflicts involving Iran, Russia, and China over the decades have led to terrorist and cyber attacks on Europe and the Americas. Geographical divisions will be both greater and lesser than in the 20th century. They will be greater because sovereignties will multiply, that is, a plethora of city-states and region-states will emerge from within existing states themselves to achieve more consequence, even as a supranational organization like the EU wanes, and one like ASEAN is destined to have little meaning in a world of intimidation and power. ASEAN is the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. Geographical divisions will also be lesser because the differences, and particularly the degree of separation, between regions like Europe and the Middle East, the Middle East and South Asia, and South Asia and East Asia will decline. The map will become more fluid and baroque, in other words, but with the same pattern repeating itself. And this same pattern will be encouraged by both the profusion and hardening of roads, railways, pipelines, and fiber optic cables. Obviously, transportation infrastructure will not defeat geography. Indeed, the very expense of building such infrastructure in many places demonstrates the undeniable fact of geography. Anyone in the energy exploration business, or who has participated in a war game involving the Baltic states or the South China Sea, knows just how much old-fashioned geography still matters. At the same time, critical transportation infrastructure constitutes yet another factor making geography, and by inference, geopolitics in our era, more oppressive and claustrophobic. To be sure, connectivity, rather than simply leading to more peace, prosperity, and cultural uniformity, as techno-optimists like to claim, will have a much more ambiguous legacy. With more connectivity, the stakes for war will be greater, and the ease in which wars can proliferate from one geographic area to another will also be greater. Corporations will be the beneficiaries of this new world, but being, for the most part, unable to provide security, they will ultimately not be in control. Nothing is more illustrative of this process than the Chinese government's attempts to build a land bridge across Central and West Asia to Europe, and a maritime network across the Indian Ocean from East Asia to the Middle East. These land and sea conduits may themselves be interlinked, as China and Pakistan, as well as Iran and India, hope to join the oil and natural gas fields of distant landlocked Central Asia with the Indian Ocean to the south. China is branding these infrastructure projects One Belt, One Road, in effect a new Silk Road. The medieval Silk Road was not a single route, but a vast and casual trading network, tenuously linking Europe with China both overland and across the Indian Ocean. The Silk Road was only named as such, the Seidenstrasse, in the late 19th century by a German geographer, Baron Ferdinand von Richthofen. The relative eclectic and multicultural nature of the Silk Road during the Middle Ages meant, according to historian Lawrence Burgreen, that it was no place for orthodoxy or single-mindedness. Medieval travelers on the Silk Road encountered a world that was, furthermore, complex, tumultuous, and menacing, but nonetheless porous. Consequently, with each new traveler's account, Europeans saw the world not as smaller and more manageable, but as bigger and more chaotic. This is a perfect description of our own time, in which the smaller the world actually becomes because of the advance of technology, the more permeable, complicated, and overwhelming it seems, with its numberless, seemingly intractable crises that are all entwined. The late 13th century Venetian merchant Marco Polo, who traveled the length and breadth of the Silk Road, is most famously associated with this world. And the route he traveled provides as good an outline as any for defining the geopolitics of Eurasia in the coming era. Faded empires in Marco Polo's path. Marco Polo, who began his 24-year-long trek to Asia by sailing down the eastern shore of the Adriatic in AD 1271, would spend considerable periods of time in Palestine, Turkey, northern Iraq, Iran in its entirety, from the Azeri and Kurdish north to the Persian Gulf, northern and eastern Afghanistan, and China's ethnic Turkic Xinjiang province, before arriving at the court of the Mongol emperor, Kublai Khan, in Kambulak, modern-day Beijing. From Kambulak, he would make forays across the whole of China and into Vietnam and Myanmar. His return route to Venice would take him across the Indian Ocean, through the Strait of Malacca to Sri Lanka, up India's western coast to Gujarat, and on side trips to Oman, Yemen, and East Africa. If the early 21st century world has a geopolitical focus, this would be it. The greater Indian Ocean from the Persian Gulf to the South China Sea, and including the Middle East, Central Asia, and China. The current Chinese regime's proposed land and maritime Silk Road duplicates exactly the one Marco Polo traveled. This is no coincidence. The Mongols, whose Yuan dynasty ruled China in the 13th and 14th centuries, were in fact early practitioners of globalization, seeking to connect the whole of habitable Eurasia in a truly multicultural empire. And Yuan China's most compelling weapon was, despite the Mongols' bloody reputation, not the sword, but trade. Gems, fabrics, spices, metals, and so on. It was trade routes, not the projection of military power, that emblemized the Pax Mongolica. Mongol grand strategy was built on commerce much more than on war. If you want to understand China's grand strategy today, look no further than Kublai Khan's empire. Yet, for Kublai Khan, it didn't altogether work. Persia and Russia were beyond Chinese control, and the Indian subcontinent, separated from China by the high wall of the Himalayas, with seas on both sides, remained its own geopolitical island. All the while, though, the great Khan strengthened his base in what always has been Chinese civilization's arable cradle, in central and eastern China, away from the Muslim minority areas of the western desert. In all of this, the geopolitical characteristics of Marco Polo's world roughly approximate our own. To be sure, Marco Polo equated the future itself with China. Coal, paper money, eyeglasses, and gunpowder were Chinese marvels unknown in Europe at the time, while the city of Hangzhou, with a giant moat and hundreds of bridges over its canals, was in Marco Polo's eyes as beautiful as Venice. But, traveling in Tibet, he also saw the dark side of Yuan Chinese rule, with its wanton destruction and forced incorporation of a distant province. Aside from the geopolitical island of India, two especially consequential territories that Marco Polo describes in his travels are Russia and Persia, or Iran, as it is now called. Russia he describes, just barely and from afar, as a profitable wasteland rich in furs, whereas Persia dictates much of his route. Persia, that is Iran, is second only to China in Marco Polo's eyes, in a similar way that the Persian Empire dominated the paths of both Alexander the Great and Herodotus. For Persia was history's first superpower in antiquity, uniting the Nile, Indus, and Mesopotamia with trade links to China. As was so often the case in history, it was all about Persia, whose language by the High Middle Ages was the main vehicle for the spread of Islam throughout the East. Thus, a map of 13th century Eurasia during Marco Polo's lifetime, overlaid by the Empire of the Great Khan and the Khans of Persia, is now the backdrop to something far more complex and technological. In all this complexity, keep in mind that empire remains the organizing principle of world affairs, given that the imperial experiences of Turkey, Iran, Russia, and China explain the geopolitical strategy of each country to this day. That same legacy also explains how each country could weaken or partially disintegrate. For it is the constancy of history that continues to define Eurasia, not only the stability wrought by empire, but also the chaos that emerged in the interregnum between imperial dynasties, as crises in the capital led to ungovernability in the far-flung provinces. And because of the way communications technology empowers individuals and small groups, in addition to the instability that erupts from the increasing interconnectedness of crises worldwide, threats to imperial-oriented power centers are now greater than ever. And this is to say nothing of the acute economic challenges all these states face, particularly Russia and China, whose own internal stability can never be taken for granted. So, think of the first cartographic stratum of the new Eurasian map as composed of faded empires, undeclared empires, albeit, though still operating from an imperial mindset, whose official territorial control, in the cases of Turkey and Iran, is far less than that of their former imperiums, and greater in the cases of Russia and China. For what makes Russia and China especially vulnerable is the fact that these states still encompass territory of truly imperial dimensions, stretching beyond the homelands of their ruling ethnic and religious groups. George Kennan said that the strongest argument for imperialism was contingent necessity, meaning unless we took those territories, somebody else would, and that this would be still worse. For this reason, imperialism, in one form or another, will never die. Turkish, Iranian, and Central Asian power. Turkey and Iran, thanks largely to their long and venerable imperial legacies, are the most coherent states in the Near East, further buttressed by their natural geographies neatly encompassing the Anatolian land bridge and the Iranian plateau. By coherent, I do not mean that their current regimes are altogether stable, only that their institutions have a degree of depth far greater than in the Arab world, so that they will likely recover from bouts of instability, such as the failed coup and consequent crackdown in Turkey in the summer of 2016. Turkey and Iran are messes, but don't think for a moment that much of the Arab world isn't an even greater mess. Take Saudi Arabia, a comparatively young and artificially drawn kingdom with no imperial legacy to draw upon, and with great regional differences between Najd and the Hajjaj, whose water-starved population may double in a few decades, making it, in political terms, less and less coherent. Moreover, mainly because of the natural gas revolution in the United States, Saudi Arabia is no longer the global swing producer of hydrocarbons. Energy expert Daniel Yergin writes, "The new Saudi strategy is to use oil revenues to diversify the economy and build the world's largest sovereign wealth fund as the investment engine for development. The target," he writes, "is to increase non-oil government revenues at least sixfold by 2030. Nevertheless, even if the kingdom achieves all or part of this goal, and that is very doubtful, it is safe to say that Saudi Arabia's geopolitical power has, at best, peaked. Turkey's dynamic regional policies under President Recep Tayyip Erdogan mark a return to a more historically rooted Ottoman imperial strategy, something in turn that was first introduced by the late Prime Minister Turgut Özal in the 1980s and early 1990s. Özal, a deeply religious Muslim like Erdogan, but without the latter's authoritarian tendencies, saw so-called Neo-Ottomanism as pluralistic and multi-ethnic, thus providing a basis for peace between Turks and their fellow Muslim Kurds, and also allowing for Turks to reach out to Turkic peoples in Central Asia, as well as to fellow Muslims in the Arab and Persian worlds. It was not an aggressive and anti-democratic strategy, in other words. To be sure, the narrow Western orientation of Turkish foreign policy that we in the West both admired and considered normal during the middle decades of the Cold War, when the military ruled Turkey, was actually an aberration, the singular invention of that fierce secularist Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, who abjured Ottoman imperialism and by the way, was no Democrat. The dictatorial Kemalist state, so geopolitically convenient to the West, will never come back. Turkish society has become too sophisticated for that. And yet it must also be said that Erdogan, in his own very compulsive authoritarianism, and in his attempt to subdue the Kurds within Anatolia itself, is to some degree a Kemalist, striving in vain for a mono-ethnic Turkish state, even as his vision of Turkey as a power broker in the Levant is very Ottoman. This is not a contradiction, though. Because of the way that ethnic Kurdish areas overlap Turkey, Syria, Iraq, and Iran, protecting Turkey's modern Kemalist borders at a time of war in Syria and Iraq requires a forward policy of Ottoman-like expansion. Turkey's worst nightmare is losing control of ethnic Kurdish areas in eastern Anatolia. Thus, it must always be on the offensive in some oblique form. That is why we see Turkey building an oil pipeline in northern Iraq, and having in the recent past supported the Kurdish Democratic Party there against the pro-Iranian Patriotic Union of Kurdistan, while also working against Kurdish defense units in Syria. Clearly, Kurdistan itself is weak and fragmented, despite its media image as being the only success story to emerge from the Iraq War. Kurdistan will ultimately provide the long-term geopolitical battleground for Turkey versus Iran, something that is a revival of the Ottoman-Safavid imperial conflicts of early modern history. Whereas Turkey's imperial tradition, Seljuk and Ottoman, lay wholly within the Islamic ages, making the values of Erdogan's rule actually very natural, Iran's imperial tradition, Median, Achaemenid, Parthian, and Sassanid, predates Islam. The exception was the Safavid dynasty, whose adoption of Shiite Islam in 1500 led to a disastrous war with the Sunni Ottoman Empire that cut off Iran from Europe. It is this history that creates a certain tension between Iran's Islamic ideology and Iran's idea of itself as a successful great power in the Near East. To wit, Hassan Rouhani, the Iranian president whose ministers negotiated the nuclear agreement with the West, would like Iran to evolve into a regional economic power with a revitalized capitalist-style system open to the world, much like China has become. But the supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, sees Iran as more like the old Soviet Union, whereby if it compromises its Islamic ideology, it is likely to disintegrate, given how ethnic Persians dominate Iran's mini-empire of minorities. Karim Sajapour of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace calls this division the pragmatists versus the principalists, those who believe in first principles. Ali Weiss of the International Crisis Group divides each of these two groups in turn into those who are more and less radical, so that there are at least four distinct factions competing for influence within Iran's multiple power centers. This extremely decentralized arrangement inherently favors continuity, according to Weiss. Both Weiss and Sajapour suggest that Iran will not move over the coming years, despite the nuclear agreement, toward the Chinese model. The model of the old, pre-Gorbachev Soviet Union is more likely to hold. That is, rather than become a truly dynamic postmodern empire of sorts and a tractor force in both the Middle East and Central Asia, with a normalized relationship with the West, Iran may continue for a number of more years as a corrupt, resource-rich, grievance-driven state. Though smaller in numbers than those who want to see a more revitalized Iran, the clerical and revolutionary guard elites will fight and die to stay in power because they have literally nowhere else to go, while many of Rouhani's supporters in the government could always flee to the West, where they were educated at the same time that the hardliners were fighting in the trenches of the Iran-Iraq War. As one analyst advises, considering the mass violence that the Iranian hardliners are perpetrating in Syria to keep Bashar al-Assad in power, just imagine what they are prepared to do to keep themselves in power inside Iran. Remember that dictatorships collapse often when the dictator himself, because of age and infirmity, loses the sheer will to remain in power. Examples of this include the Iranian Shah in 1979, Nicolae Ceausescu in Romania in 1989, and Hosni Mubarak in Egypt in 2011. That certainly won't happen soon to the murderous elites now ruling Iran. Iran will likely continue onward as a semi-dysfunctional power with an aggressive foreign policy in the Levant. There may be small uprisings in future years in places like Balochistan in the southeast of the country and in Khuzestan in the southwest, but they will be containable. Iran, with a civilizational sense of itself to no less a degree than China or India, or Turkey even, will not dissolve like the artificial states of the Levant and other parts of the Arab world, nor will Iran progress, however. In terms of atmosphere, if not in the specifics, both Iran and Turkey in the coming years might come to resemble the Turkey of the long decade of the 1970s, when Turkey was nominally democratic, but a political and institutional mess, dominated by the cult of the military, with a weak center-left prime minister, Bülent Ecevit, who ended up invading Cyprus. Turkey and Iran, both slowly calcifying under very different types of authoritarian regimes, elected or not, will, nevertheless, remain safe from outright collapse, despite political upheavals to come, especially after Iran's supreme leader dies. Their old-new rivalry over Kurdistan eventually will come to overshadow the greater disintegration of Syria and Iraq, whose formal power centers in Damascus and Baghdad will never again govern effectively because of all the regional players, with their vastly different geopolitical agendas, implicated in the fighting everywhere between the Mediterranean and the Iranian plateau. The map of former Syria and Iraq will continue to resemble a child's messy finger painting, with Sunni and Shiite war bands expanding and contracting their areas of control, the result being flimsy and radical microstates, with cities like Mosul and Aleppo oriented as much toward each other as toward their former respective capitals in the way of old caravan routes. Given a somewhat diminished Saudi Arabia to the south, the continued cratering in the desert reaches of the Levant will further leverage the strength of the politically troubled Turkish and Iranian plateaus. Remember that right now there are millions of Arab refugees from these wars stuck in the region whose children are not being educated, making the next generation even more prone to radical Islamist propaganda. Concomitantly, it is in both the Turkish and Iranian national interest, whatever Ankara and Tehran may say publicly, to keep the Arabs weak, divided, and warring against each other. In sum, even the collapse of ISIS and the survival, or removal, of the Bashar al-Assad regime will not lead to any real form of stability. Turkish and Iranian influence, because of the deep religiosity of the regimes in Ankara and Tehran, is strikingly limited in the post-Soviet Caucasus and Central Asia. The energy powerhouse of Azerbaijan helps illustrate what I mean. Azerbaijan's ethnic and linguistic affinity with Turkey resulted in extremely close relations between Baku and Ankara in the 1990s, when Turkey, like Azerbaijan, was secular. But the more Islamic that Turkey becomes, the more it becomes estranged from Azerbaijan, which still unabashedly reveres Atatürk's devotion to secularism, even if Turkey itself no longer does. Then there is Turkey's decision to work with Russia to develop a gas pipeline from Siberia to Europe under the Black Sea, which competes with Azerbaijan's own gas export plans. As for Iran, theoretically it should wield considerable influence in the Caucasus and Central Asia, owing to its demographic, cultural, and linguistic weight, for Persia remains, in historical terms, the organizing principle of this entire region. Moreover, Iran is traditionally a Central Asian power as much as a Middle Eastern one. But Tehran's sterile Islamic ideology repulses these countries, whose traditions are still influenced by Soviet atheism, as well as by Turkic syncretism and shamanism, which, along with the brutal repression of regime opponents, are the real reasons why Islamic rebellions have not taken hold, at least yet, in the region. This is where Iran's Islamic ideology interferes with its largely pre-Islamic imperial tradition. Thus, as we move eastward along Marco Polo's path and leave behind the faded imperial influence of Turkey and Iran, we very quickly run up against that of China, whose prestige here is greater than that of either Turkey, Iran, Russia, or America, for that matter. The Russian invasion of Greater Georgia in 2008 was a pivot point in this process. Until then, Armenia was aligned with Russia, and Georgia was aligned with the United States and Europe. Also aligned with the West was energy-rich Azerbaijan, owing to its oil and natural gas pipelines that bypass Russia and run from Baku through Georgia and Turkey to the Mediterranean. But the Muslim Azeris saw the American desertion in 2008 of Georgia, a Christian nation no less, during its hour of need, and realized that Washington no longer could be trusted in a crisis, even if the Azeris themselves continued to detest the Russians. And yet the Russians now sell arms to the Azeris, even while they take the Armenians for granted. In the late 1970s, Moscow deserted its ally Somalia for Somalia's archenemy Ethiopia, because the latter was a wealthier and more populous country. Moscow would like to similarly trade up in the Caucasus from Armenia to Azerbaijan, but it cannot as yet, since the regional situation is actually far more complicated still. Here is the context. The Azeri leadership, as well as the leaderships of Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, and other former Soviet republics in Inner Asia, secular and authoritarian all, have been terrified by the Arab Spring and the Islamic uprisings that subsequently have taken advantage of it. They also have been terrified by Russia's aggression in Ukraine, as well as by tensions between Russia and Turkey, and by the drop in energy prices. They have no friends in this unraveling world, it seems, and the United States appears to matter increasingly less to them, especially as its eventual withdrawal, perhaps in defeat, from nearby Afghanistan could leave a vacuum there. So, gradually, with the help of Chinese economic and political support, these former Soviet republics have been strengthening their institutions, quietly removing pro-Russian elements from their bureaucracies and de-linking their economies measurably from Russia's. In general, they have been standing up to the Russians, so that Russia's leverage only remains pivotal in Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan because of the former's very long border with Russia and the latter's institutional weakness. The larger picture here is that state legitimacy in Central Asia, despite the artificial creation of many of these republics by Stalin, in the short run at least, has proven somewhat stronger than expected. The small states of Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan, with their divisive mountainous geographies, are obvious exceptions. Uzbekistan, following the death of leader Islam Karimov, will be the real test case, though. In sum, Russia, with its own declining economy, is stymied in the region, and the Chinese, with the roads, railways, bridges, tunnels, and pipelines they are building, are recalling the days of the Tang Dynasty in the 8th and 9th centuries, when Chinese imperial influence extended across Central Asia into northeastern Iran. In 2013, China moved demonstrably ahead of Russia in terms of regional trade, doing $50 billion in commerce with the five former Soviet Central Asian republics, compared to Russia's $30 billion. Chinese companies now own almost a quarter of Kazakhstan's oil production and more than half of Turkmenistan's gas exports. Central Asia is unique in that it is the only place where all the great powers converge, writes Zhou Huasheng, a professor at Fudan University in Shanghai. After all, historic Central Asia consists not only of the former Soviet republics, but also of Mongolia, Chinese Xinjiang, East Turkestan, and Afghanistan. And in addition to the impact of China and Russia in the former Soviet republics, shaped in turn by their own imperial legacies, the United States remains militarily engaged in Afghanistan, while Iran, through much of its imperial history, has been dominant in western Afghanistan, as has India in eastern Afghanistan. Indeed, while we have been accustomed to conceptually seeing the former Soviet republics as a separate unit, their destiny increasingly will be interwoven with what happens next door in restive Xinjiang and war-torn Afghanistan. This does not mean that Central Asia is where world power will be predominantly decided, but it does mean that Central Asia will be a register of those power relationships. That is, Central Asia will show us who has the upper hand and who does not. Russia and the Intermarium. To the north of all this complexity and turmoil lies Russia, whose Eastern Orthodox Imperium did not take part in the historical ages, the Renaissance and the Enlightenment, that made Europe what it is today, even as the medieval czars long before Napoleon and Hitler faced invasion from Swedes, Poles, and Teutonic Knights, and thus chose to ally with the Mongols. Vladimir Putin's Eurasianism is deeply rooted in this past, and so empire is the Russian state's default option. Putin knows that the mid-17th century Tsarist imperial expansion south into the medieval heartland of Kievan Rus, Ukraine that is, toward the Black Sea, paid great dividends, for it marked the early disintegration of Russia's ultimate enemy, the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. Stalin knew this history in his bones too, and was therefore guided by a so-called revolutionary imperial paradigm to defend Russia against real and perceived threats, especially those coming from Central and Eastern Europe. And because the Middle East adjoins Central Eastern Europe, its anarchy is something that Putin also cannot now ignore, especially given Russia's equities in the adjacent Caucasus. Therefore, Putin looks at the greater Middle East and Central Eastern Europe and sees a single region. Russia's own Eurasian geography lends itself to this realization. What all this adds up to is that the geographical heart of the challenge posed by Russia becomes the Black Sea Basin. Here is where Russia intersects with Ukraine, Turkey, Eastern Europe, and the Caucasus. Or, explained another way, where Europe meets the Near East, and where the former Russian, Ottoman, and Habsburg imperial conflict systems all merge. To be sure, the Greater Black Sea region constitutes a geopolitical concept that unites the wars in Syria and Ukraine, and puts Turkey front and center alongside the Caucasian and Balkan pivot states of Azerbaijan and Romania to counter Russia. The Black Sea is no less a conflict system than the Caribbean was in the 19th century, and the South and East China Seas are today. Yet the Black Sea does not register within the logic of Cold War area studies around which the U.S. defense and security bureaucracy remains organized. This is because the Black Sea falls within and among other regions, and thus emblemizes the fluid and organic geography that now gives definition to Eurasia in the first place. Putin intellectually grasps this better than we do. His tactical skill is rooted in an accurate geographical conception. Thus, both Ukraine and Syria are inseparable from Putin's challenge to the Baltic states and the Balkans. This reality rejuvenates the 1920s concept of the Intermarium, Latin for between the seas, the Baltic and Black Seas, that is. The Intermarium constitutes the contested rimland from Estonia in the north to Romania and Bulgaria in the south, and to the Caucasus in the east that once framed the conflict zone between Germany and Russia, and now frames the conflict zone between the United States and Russia. American power worldwide will therefore be heavily determined by its ability to keep Russia from Finlandizing this contested rimland. Meanwhile, Europe is no longer geopolitically protected from Russia the way it was during the post-Cold War, nor, as I've said, is Europe protected from the Levant and North Africa, as the Mediterranean basin, by way of Muslim migration, becomes truly unified for the first time in hundreds of years. Thus, we are back to a much older cartography that recalls the High Middle Ages, in which the East did not begin in any one particular place, because regions overlapped and were more vaguely defined, even as the sense of a homeland was strictly local, limited to a city or town and its surrounding countryside. To wit, the Near East, however much it may be denied, begins inside Europe itself now, given the comparatively weak institutions, the comparatively high levels of corruption, and the demonstrable presence of Russian organized crime groups that burden the states of the Balkans with a higher level of political instability than the states of Central and Western Europe. This is itself a legacy of communism and the long European war. Yes, the dichotomy of the Orient and the Occident is breaking down the world over, even as subtle gradations continue to persist. Tung China and the Lesson of Afghanistan. In Eurasia, Russia will be contained by China much more than by the United States. In fact, the whole underlying logic of Russia's Eurasian Customs Union is to limit, to the extent that it can, Chinese influence. China constitutes a very distinct imperial mindset. Because it was a vast empire for thousands of years under many dynasties, China simply takes for granted its superiority, and consequently has never sought to influence others in the proper way of governance. This puts it at odds with the democratic universalism of the United States, which has sought religious-like conversion to its principles worldwide. China's particular imperial tradition allows it to deal with all sorts of regimes, good and evil, without any notion of guilt. For untold centuries, Beijing's only problem was the so-called barbarians on the steppelands, partially encircling Han China's arable lowland cradle, the Tibetans, the Turkic Muslim Uyghurs, the Inner Mongolians, and others, who either had to be violently subdued, bribed, or demographically overwhelmed, exactly as they must be today. China's 22 urban clusters, each containing at least one megacity, all happen to be located within Han China's arable cradle, which constitutes the territory of Chinese imperial dynasties throughout history, and excludes this semicircle of steppelands. It was only in the mid-18th century that the last of those dynasties, that of the Qing or Manchus, who were themselves outsiders, expanded into the barbarian desert and steppe regions, thus preparing the geographical context of the current Chinese state, a state that overlaps with Muslim Central Asia. And yet, this dangerous periphery that has threatened the Han cradle still exists, not only inside China, but beyond its current borders. China hopes its Silk Road development strategy can make a political end run around these volatile minority regions, economically pacifying these minorities, as it were, though it also might bring Muslim Uyghur separatists in Western China into greater contact with radical Islamists in South Asia, Central Asia, and the Middle East. Uyghur separatists already have received training in the Pakistan-Afghanistan border area. In other words, connectivity does not necessarily lead to a more peaceful world, especially because changes in the status quo, even for the better, can lead to more ethnic unrest. For example, in Xinjiang, East Turkestan, the very process of economic modernization, in which the Muslim Uyghurs actually can benefit, plays a part in shaping a more radical identity for them, immersed as the Uyghurs are in economic competition with the Han Chinese. Whereas the Han have viewed the Tibetans somewhat like the Americans have viewed the Navajo, as exotic reminders of how they successfully conquered a continent, the Han view the Uyghurs with absolute dread. For Islam represents an alternative identity for the Uyghurs, one unconnected to the Chinese state. Unlike the Tibetans with their Dalai Lama, the Uyghurs don't have an elite leader and educated bureaucracy with which to communicate with Beijing. Rather, they represent an inchoate, undirected force of upheaval that could be triggered by an environmental or other emergency. The Uyghurs, as one astute China observer told me, are the bomb under the carpet of the Chinese state. Remember that the core argument of the late Harvard professor Samuel Huntington's theory of a clash of civilizations which those who criticized Huntington either overlooked or completely failed to grasp, was that ethnic and cultural tension is central to the process of modernization and development itself. China's rapid-fire modernization is now mightily testing Huntington's thesis. China's infrastructure expansion across Central Asia is directly related to its maritime expansion in the South and East China Seas. After all, China is only able to act aggressively in its adjacent seas because it is now, for the time being, secure on land to a degree it has never been in its history. Threatened constantly by the peoples of the steppe in the west, southwest, and north, with the exception of the voyages of Admiral Zheng He during the Ming Dynasty in the early 15th century, China never actually did have a maritime tradition in the east. But globalization, with its exaggerated emphasis on sea lines of communication, has necessitated Chinese power projection into the blue water extensions of its own continental landmass. Because that requires China to remain secure on land, it also means the permanent subjugation of the Muslim Uyghurs, Tibetans, and Inner Mongolians. And thus, we have the One Belt, One Road strategy. In short, China's ethnic demons within its borders lead it to push out militarily and economically well beyond its borders. China's new Silk Road is very much in keeping with its medieval precedent, when Tang armies threaded their way through the space between Mongolia and Tibet to establish protectorates as far as Iranian Khorasan. Indeed, almost touching China's dangerous steppeland periphery through much of late antiquity, the Middle Ages, and the early modern era was Persia, whose linguistic and imperial domain stretched from the Mediterranean to Central Asia. Both China and Persia were rich, settled agricultural civilizations besieged by warlike desert peoples, even as they were in contact with each other because of the Silk Road. And both were great empires humiliated by Western powers during the modern era. Such is the emotional and historical bedrock for sustaining Sino-Iranian relations today. Iran's deputy head of railways, Hossan Ashouri, says, "Our goal in the Silk Road plan is first to connect Iran's market to China's, rather than to Central Asia per se." Thus, even as the theme of the Eurasian interior is weaker and weaker states, with the great former empires weakening at a somewhat slower pace than the rest, there also will be more intensified linkages and interactions between all of them. So forget the dichotomy between the pessimists who predict anarchy and the optimists who predict greater connectivity. Both trends will happen simultaneously. And there is no contradiction in this, as long as one thinks outside the paradigm of linear progress with which the liberal mind is obsessed. Think again of Marco Polo's world, one of great overwhelming danger for the traveler in which a Silk Road nexus, with all its sinews of wealth creation, nevertheless existed. Of all these countries, Pakistan will be the chief register of China's ability to join its Silk Road across Eurasia with its maritime Silk Road across the Indian Ocean. This branch of the Silk Road will require the full force of China's proposed $46 billion investment in order to build a 1,800-mile superhighway and high-speed railway from Pakistan's Arabian seaport of Gwadar, a port that China already has built, north across the Balochistan Desert and the Karakoram Mountains into China's western Xinjiang province. Nothing since independence in 1947 has the potential to help stabilize Pakistan, calming its frontier insurgencies, than the completion of this project, and nothing would do more to firm up China's domination of its own steppeland periphery. In fact, Chinese pressure, much more than American pressure, may have caused the Pakistanis to crack down on terrorist networks in North Waziristan some years back, since the proposed Silk Road gives Beijing leverage in Islamabad that Washington can only dream of having. It is doubtful, however, that China can save Pakistan. While it is true that Pakistan's government is increasingly being held accountable by a burgeoning media and non-governmental organizations, thereby expanding civil society at the top end of the spectrum in Islamabad and Lahore, and it is also true that inter-party warfare in Islamabad has lessened somewhat. The country, in fundamental ways, continues to deteriorate. Electricity blackouts,